Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's program is a little bread, a little vegetarian, and a little bread with meat to finish.
It's actually a lot of bread.
It's a lot of bread.
Let me tell you a story that's not so, won't seem so funny 60 years later. But you know how in high school there was always some guy who had this bright idea? Some sort of clever idea, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. So he wrote on the chalkboard, "Bread is the staff of life, and the life of this staff is one long loaf."
You made that up.
No, I didn't. The teacher didn't think it was very amusing either. I think we all got caned because no one would admit it was us who had written it there. And I don't remember.
Caning is positively medieval.
It was practically medieval. Remember how long ago I started high school, and you know. But seriously, bread is big. Bread is making a huge comeback in people's lives.
Good bread. I mean, we pay attention to quality now.
Absolutely. Excellent quality bread. So.
And artisan, I mean, which is actually our first up guest. I think everybody should have this book, Artisan Bread by Keith Cohen, and he's a delight to talk to. I can tell, Keith Cohen, that you're a real New Yorker. You got that accent. We're from Queens, is it?
I grew up in Queens. Born in Brooklyn, grew up in Queens.
All right. So you now are an artisan bread maker, and it's an absolutely amazing story. You graduated from college, didn't have really much of a clue what to do, and you got steered for a job in sales at this artisanal bread bakery, which had been in operation for 100 years. Now, how good a story is that? You couldn't make that one up.
No, you couldn't. I was exposed to food at an early age. I learned to cook for myself, I guess, when I was around 12 years old. I remember telling my mom that I wasn't thrilled with something she made for dinner.
Uh-oh.
And very calmly, she picked up my plate, threw it in the garbage, and said, "Learn to cook for yourself."
So me and my big mouth.
Me and my big mouth. And it was a trial and error experience. So there were certain nights that I went hungry because my cooking skills at 12 and 13 were less than stellar. But even in college, to pay my way through college, I worked as a line cook. And after I graduated, I was wait staff. So there was a little bit of a background there. And I really wasn't sure, like I said, what I was planning on doing with the rest of my life. Doctor, lawyer, kind of the standard way of making a living, was not in my card. And I was able to get into this profession, and I was successful.
Well, you have certain personality traits and interests that lend themselves easily to baking bread, I think. This is how I view it, because I view baking bread as creative, but I also think it's part of a science that you have to understand. And some of the science I don't really get my head around. You also were interested in history. You studied history. Where you are, the shop itself was loaded with history, but also the whole field of artisanal baking goes back to, what, pre-Egyptian?
So the Egyptians are really, they're probably the first ones that we would associate with modern bread making. As the history says, it was the Egyptians, and the Greeks, after the Egyptians, kind of perfected the bread making. So in my background, I love science, I'm mechanically inclined, and I'm creative. So those three attributes, it's very much entrenched in artisan bread making.
Now, your book, who is the audience for your book, or the intended audience?
Well, the intended audience can be a professional chef at a restaurant, or can be the home baker that really wants to produce these old world wholesome loaves. And really, it kind of lends itself to anyone interested in cooking in general. It gives you a background on different wheats. It gives you background on different mixing techniques, growing your own starter, which is integral in producing these type of breads. It has a wide and varied audience. I expect it to transcend just the U.S. and in other cultures that have really adopted bread making.
Okay.
For instance, Japan.
Really?
Japan has a really blossoming artisan bread making community.
You know, they're making single malt scotch too. I don't think neither one of those is part of the Japanese culture.
It's not part of their culture, but I have to tell you, they are doing a phenomenal job.
Yeah, well, there's some of their single malt scotches are winning world. So, but what you picked up, you went actually and worked for 14 years as a salesperson, but then you filled all kinds of other roles in this artisanal bakery.
Correct.
So you learned everything there was about bread making.
I did. And part of my motivation was, as being a salesperson, being the face of the bakery that I worked for, I needed to really know my product. I think in this day and age, people sell stuff they don't really know. And bread is one thing that you have to be passionate about. So I started to delve into the way it was being produced for the company I worked for, different starters. On occasion, I would have to fix some of the machinery. And really, it was a little bit self-serving. I could either fix the machine or deal with the customer complaints the next day. So I had the ability, and little by little, I got immersed in the entire business. And at a certain point, it was time for me to go out on my own, and I wanted to really purchase not only a bakery, but some history, some New York history. Being born in Brooklyn and raised in Queens, I am a real New Yorker, and you could probably tell from my accent.
Yeah, I said that right away. But, mainly this bakery was known for serving the local Upper East Side population, which was, German, Eastern European?
It was mostly Eastern European at that point. It's in the Yorkville section of Manhattan, or the Upper East Side, and there was a lot of Hungarian immigrants there as well.
Okay, but you had standard... one of the things that amazed me was, back in the day, bread was sold not by the loaf, but by the pound.
That is correct, and when I took over the business, it was still being sold that way. It became a little bit difficult for us to weigh out every single loaf. When somebody would call and say, how much is your pumpernickel? You would have to give them a range somewhere between a 50-cent range on what it would cost. Mm-hmm. So we decided a number of years ago to just sell it by the loaf. We do sell two breads still by the pound.
Mm-hmm.
We have a communal 10-pound rye that we cut off wedges and sell by the pound. And something else that I have that I started about a year and a half ago called the Levon Locale. And
Levon Locale.
Levon. And mm-hmm. In the book you'll read about what Levon is, but it's a starter bread.
Right.
So there's no commercial yeast. And the Locale part is a little play on words.
Mm-hmm.
50% of the flour we use is locally grown to my New York State region. So if anyone has ever been to France and had Poulain, as we discussed before,
mm-hmm.
It is a very similar type bread.
Huh.
And it has an incorporation of this local white wheat flour. It has even though it's white flour, there is a considerable amount of bran and germ left, similar to a whole wheat. We use rye, and we also use a little bit of durum.
You keep experimenting, and you keep tweaking recipes. Apparently, you inherited a pinch of that, a dash of that kind of recipes, right?
Some of the recipes, yes.
Yeah.
So the standard recipes, what we did is, when I took over, because it was a family bakery and people had worked there for many years and very familiar, it was the way old cooking used to be. A pinch of this, a pinch of that. We kind of standardize it. One of the things that we wanted to be able to do, not only for the general public that come into the retail store, but for my wholesale customers, to weigh everything out. So we're pretty meticulous in the way we go about mixing our doughs.
Well, and you have different, flours, and you explain them all and explain how each one reacts differently to water, which makes it really complicated, doesn't it?
It does make it a little complicated. All the flours are rye flour, okay? It doesn't react the same way a wheat flour does. A durum flour doesn't. When you create the starters or the pre-ferments using those flours, it acts very differently. A dark rye starter will acidify quickly if it's not refrigerated. So what happens is it starts to break down and becomes very acidic, and it will ruin your dough. So that's something to be careful of.
Who ever knew that there were six classes of wheat grains? This is really getting complicated, isn't it?
It's complicated but simple. And what I try to do with the book was to lay out the best I could kind of the background of the different styles of wheat, how they react, so the home baker could also take my recipes and kind of have their own creative side to it. So if it's for my Cabernet Rustica, which is purely white flour, they could say, hey, I want to add a little bit of whole wheat here. How will that be? And a lot of the recipes lend itself for that modification. So by having a good background and knowing how different flours react and water absorption and mixing times and things of that sort, the book will be a not a Bible on bread making, but more of something as really a great guide point for the home baker or even a more professional.
Now, you spend like 170-some pages on that, and then all of a sudden you start out on something else entirely different that I don't think I'd ever heard of before, which is incorporating wine and beer into bread. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Well, as far as what I had been taught and read, first society, as we mentioned before, the Egyptians, were the first ones to have a leavened bread. For people who are familiar with the story of Passover, the unleavened bread, or matzah, is a key component of that story. And they were also the first ones to perfect beer making and wine making. So the yeast that is used in beer making or wine making, or on the actual the skins of the grapes, the wine grapes, permeated the air and got into their doughs and act as a natural leavening agent. So what I wanted to do was to kind of incorporate some localness in the beginning. This was back in 2008, to my product, and I went really far back in time, way past the baking that we're familiar with the Germans and the French and the Italians. And every year, I pick these Cabernet and Chardonnay grapes and grow these pre-ferments or starters. Some people like to keep a legacy starter, which is good. For us, in a larger facility, I like to make brand new starters every year.
Yeah, that startled me. I mean, the idea that, well, first of all, it startles me, the concept that these little microorganisms are little animals, and you've got to feed them and everything, and then keep them going. But I never heard of anybody who just, is there a, it's not homicide, what is it, will you kill off the culture?
Right.
And start one from scratch again every year.
Yeah, this culture is all over. People who are listening now are probably familiar with San Francisco sourdough,
right?
Which is very... They did research recently that there is a difference why no one can recreate the San Francisco sourdough anywhere else. They come close, but no one has yet to say, this is just like San Francisco.
Why?
Because the yeast that are active over San Francisco Bay is from San Francisco. I guess you can transport some of the air over to New York, but that free-wielding yeast that's just in the air is really just based in San Francisco. It's not the same yeast or the spores that you would find in downtown Manhattan. So we call our Soho sourdough as a little play on that.
Now, when you're making the wine-based bread, though, the only thing you're really taking from the grapes is the yeasts.
Well, I'm using the grapes as a whole vehicle.
Okay.
So the grapes are picked, they're not even washed, and they're immersed in either a colander or you can use cheesecloth, and you add flour and water. It's a little more complicated than that. You need to read about it in the book. But that is the overall premise of doing that. And that also led me to my beer bread. I wanted to take some of these great starters that I made, whole wheat and the dark rye and the white, and add another part of this trilogy of fermentation. And beer, your beer or wine, cheese, and bread has really been known for hundreds of years as, the fermentation process. They're very good examples of it. So what we do with the beer bread, I found a local brewery here that produces a very dark ale, similar to Guinness. I personally think it's better, but there are plenty of Irish people out there that would wring my neck for saying that. But we substitute about 10% of the liquid or water with this beer, and it really gives a great malty finish and aids in the whole fermentation process.
So the guys at the brewery have really done some of your work for you already?
They've helped a little bit. And what it does is it adds that extra background flavor. If I didn't tell you there was beer in it, you wouldn't really be able to pick up on it, but you would say there's a certain malty quality to this bread. And I really love it, and I think it makes for a unique product. And there are other things we've done recently with beer. Same company has produced a rye-based beer. So we went back in time because of the heritage of the store, and we started to produce on a monthly special something called corn rye, which a lot of New Yorkers will remember, but it's very hard to get. But it was a more modern take, and I used this rye-based beer in it. And it really added a great flavor.
Now, one of the things that I think was the most interesting in this book is that you have never stopped learning, and recently, at least it seems that way in the book, you decided that you better tackle something you'd never been successful with before, which is how to make French bread, French bread in long sticks called baguettes. So tell us the story of how that came about, and I guess we think it's coming to a happy ending just shortly.
Yes. So I'm trying to recreate, or I wanted to recreate, somewhat of a national bread. Even though it's about 100 years old in France, most people would probably swear that the baguette has been around since the beginning of time. But I didn't want my interpretation of it. Even in France itself, they are going through their own bread resurgence. Just like a lot of things, as modern technology takes over, things tend to morph, and people are looking for profit. Things change, and they don't have the same soul that I think bread is soulful, that they once had. So I teamed up. I found Professor Kaplan, who's a world-renowned expert, bread expert, French bread especially. I was able to get a hold of him, and I kind of told him my story, and I said, I need to go to France. Can you help me? Which he did. And myself and my head baker spent 10 days there in Chartres and Paris learning the art of making French baguettes. And the nicest thing was, some of it was, I guess, classroom-based, but a lot of it was practical in the basements of these old Parisian bakeries. So everything in a classroom or in a laboratory works out perfectly. But what do you do in the real world when you have to make 1,000 and it's hot and you have to make other bread and someone called in sick? So we really were able to see that it is a practical type bread that can be made consistently and more than 5 pieces at a time. One of the key ingredients that I've done is I import the flour from France. I felt it very important. It's essential to recreate this French baguette. For the home baker, there's a lot of good flour out there. May not be 100% exact, but there's other flour out there that will give you excellent results.
Now, complete the story for us, because you're about to find out whether you really passed the test?
Yes. So part of the agreement was that I maintain the standards, which I'm happy to do. So in the next 2 weeks, I'm having one of my French teachers and the professor to come over. They're going to be in New York for a tasting. So there is this quality control. So even though I'm 43 years old and I have my own business, I have my bread daddy that's going to come and check on my work, and quite honestly, he's my mentor, and I work really hard to impress him because he's so well known and critical. And you know what? For me, critical is good. It just makes me work harder and better and smarter, and I'm hoping, again, the way the book is written, that people will take their finished product, the breads, whatever they choose to make, and share it with their friends and really say, hey, this was great, but I don't have the open cell structure that it looks like in the book.
It looks good in the book, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the book was written in such a way that a lot of people will have enough information that they can kind of work out any situation that comes about, whether it was mixed too cold or it's proofing too fast, and they'll be able to learn to make those corrections.
Yeah, I mean, the readers, I think, will be not only just fascinated with the story of it. I mean, the way you write is very, you get engaged right away with this. You learn so much, and people who are afraid, there's a whole chapter called Experimentation and Troubleshooting where you cover just about every possible disaster, which is where I would read before I took up any of your recipes. But it's a great book. I mean, again, it's called Artisan Bread, 100 Years of Techniques and Recipes, and I think that's an understatement, really.
I have this feeling deep down inside that somehow you know you're going to pass the test.
I think I will.
I'm sure you will. And it was a pleasure to have you join us today.
You too.
And we wish you continued success. And when you invent some kind of new kind of bread, you'd better let us know.
I'll definitely do that. Thank you very much for having me on.
And you'll hear from another bread expert right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and just as Peter said, we're going to have more bread. This one is interesting because the baker is actually called Josie Baker, and his book is Josie Baker Bread by Josie Baker. There's a lot of baker in there.
Before we started out, I thought he was an amateur bread maker. It turns out he's an amateur bread maker turned real bread maker, real large scale baker, kind of like Keith Cohen, but instead of buying into it, he grew it all himself. So he's obviously an interesting guy to hear from. I said to Josie Baker when we started the conversation before we started this recording that it's lucky that he's not something else that he does for a living, like a butcher or a candlestick maker or a wheelwright or any of those things.
But then you ended up with banker.
But then I finished up with banker instead of baker, and then it was all downhill from there. but seriously, I didn't read the instructions all the way through in preparation for this interview. So I got as far as the story where you started, somebody gave you a sourdough starter and you made a loaf of bread and it was so delicious you made more, and eventually you got to making like 12 at a time.
That's true.
And then the story stopped, and I didn't realize that you in fact went on and you have a baking empire now. So let's start with that for those people who haven't been reading the story, haven't been reading about $4 toast. What's your day job?
Well, just like my name would imply, I am in fact a baker. And I own a bakery in San Francisco, the Mill,
which is highly reputed. Let's get that in there. I mean, you've got a testimonial things from Alice Waters and on your book.
That's true. Yes, I'm very flattered about that. But it's been a heck of a whirlwind. If I had any idea it was going to be this popular and this busy, I probably would have. I don't know what I would have done. But
what did you actually do before that?
So before that, I worked at the University of California at Berkeley, developing teachers' guides and children's books.
Oh, there you go. Fits right in, huh?
Fits right in. I'm no. So when I started working on this book, it was
absolutely. And all this talk about $4 toast is a lie. I know, because Josie says it's only $3.75.
True, it's $3.50 or $3.75. Yeah,
and you started.
Not only that.
Let him explain hailstorm he started.
Yeah, that's
what
toppings.
Happened.
Well, people got very upset about our toast. They started telling us that we were ruining San Francisco, which hurt my feelings.
Were you actually toasting it or just baking the bread?
Oh no, we do everything. We bake the bread and we make some of the toppings and we toast it in a very particular way to our exacting standards.
And then we
hand it to you with a smile.
That's very good.
but you don't make one with Marmite and marmalade on it yet.
But when we do, we're going to name it after you.
It's going to be called a beer, and it's going to cost at least 4 1/4 so that I can get 50 cents a slice out of it. but seriously, I love this. I really love this book because a lot of books pretend to be how-to. They really do, but the instructions are so complicated. You know perfectly well. You have no chance of success. In this case, you start from the very beginning with a few elementary instructions, and some suggestions about why making bread might be fun. And then you walk everybody through, like, a little step at a time, sometimes just with discussion, saying, now this is what you're supposed to do next. And I'm guessing you found out this the hard way.
Well, you read that book. You read it very closely.
I did.
yeah, absolutely. You know, the first chapter in the book is written for people who haven't had much success baking, whether that means they haven't tried it at all or they've just had a few failures. And so, yeah, the first recipe is written in the most simplest form that I could muster, with the most basic ingredients and equipment, and you know, it's supposed to give that beginning baker just the experience of success and encouragement of wow, I can bake bread.
See,
I can do
this. It's really simple. Goes the water, and here you are pouring the water.
No, here's what I thought was going on.
A bit of yeast goes a long way. I mean, all of this is spelled out. I don't know how you could miss.
This is how I got confused. Because it sounded like a home baker teaching another home baker how to home bake bread. So this is where I missed the bakery part.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I really hadn't, when I started work on the book, I'd only been baking for a couple years. And so I was very in touch with all of the trials and tribulations of trying to bake bread in your home, both in your home oven, which lots of people, you know, think that their oven is not good enough to bake really good bread, and I assure you it is. Yeah, you can have the crappiest oven on the face of the planet, and you can still make remarkable bread in it, I promise you.
Yeah, not only that, every mistake you could possibly make, it sounds like you must have recorded them all. And then you played them back.
Yeah, exactly, man. Yeah, because I was pushing it. I was baking, started out obviously baking one loaf at a time, but by the end of my run of baking at home, I was baking 12 loaves at a time. And one day, it was Thanksgiving in 2010, I actually baked 60 loaves of bread in my home oven, and strangers came to my doorstep and picked it up.
Oh, wow.
Boy, $4 a slice, that's a small fortune.
He didn't toast it, he just silted it. Now, you have a sense of humor, I know you do, because we've been laughing ever since we called. But you have this absolutely improbable item called Possible Bread Baking Schedules.
That's true.
So you have this column that says what you're doing, and there's a choice of pre-mixed, mixed pre-ferment, mixed dough, put dough in fridge, shape into loaf, bake, step, 8. But then you have things like after dinner, early bird, lunch break. What is all this about? Before breakfast, after dinner. I mean, it's just hysterical.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's really hard to do when you're first learning how to bake bread is fit it into your day, right?
Because exactly.
If we were all just sitting around all day long, we'd all be the best bakers in the world. We got all the time we can imagine. But fitting it in when you got a day job, when you have a kid, when you're going to school, when you're going to the gym, you know, when you're going out to eat your toast with Marmite on it, it can be really hard to figure that out. So what I did there is I just gave you two possibilities for how you could structure your bread making and fit it into your day. Because the thing is if you use the fridge to slow down the fermentation in the dough, you can really fit it into any schedule you have. You just need to learn a little bit of the basics about how to read dough, what stage is it at, and what does it need at that point.
Now,
got it. So it's almost like it would be easier if it could talk to you.
Oh, God, if only it could talk to you.
maybe you can invent that.
That's a good idea.
Talking yeast.
Well, you know, you have so many varieties here. The photographs are so luscious. Right there you have me hooked. And baked bread in years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it just looking at that. And I recall the feeling, you have a little section on how exciting it is to slash your bread.
Now, oh, yeah.
Now, if anybody's listening to this and has never done that, they don't get it, how exciting it is to slash the bread. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, it's one of the most exciting moments because you've spent so much time working on that loaf of bread. Most of it, you're just waiting, not doing anything active, you're waiting. But you started that loaf of bread a day and a half, 2 days before, and now it's the moment where it's about to begin its transformation. And so when you take your razor blade and you slash the top of the loaf, you cut it in this very purposeful way so that it can expand in the oven and become the most beautiful and delicious version of itself. And so it really is, and, you know, in the bakery these days, you know, I do it to you know, 200 loaves at a time. But you can settle into this really nice place where really the only thing that you're paying attention to is that act that you're committing to the loaf of bread before you put it in that oven and it actually turns into a loaf.
And that's why you slash it.
Yeah.
That's why you slash it.
It's not out of frustration or anything like that.
No. Well, sometimes. I mean, so you can get out some aggression for sure, but the bread will show that. So.
Yes, I never understood bread machines, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the most satisfying thing about baking bread is kneading it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, bread machines I think probably are in order to address that issue I was talking about earlier, which is fitting bread making into your day. Because, you know, with the bread machine, you just pour all the ingredients in and you leave it alone. And you come back a few hours later and the bread's all done. But, yeah, I mean, if you compare the bread that's made in a bread machine to a loaf that's made by someone by hand who's really paid attention to every step of the process, it's no comparison.
Now, let's take a different look at this book. We already talked about how it begins and how it's super straightforward, and any fool can do it except me, probably. As you get towards the end of this book, the recipes get more ambitious. They get more complicated.
Yeah.
And delicious.
Yeah. Where are people going to be able to get to with the help of your book and your advice?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, they can go as far as they want. I mean, yeah, there's recipes in there that, you know, the first chapter is all about the beginning baker and trying to make really simple loaves with commercial yeast. But then the second chapter, it's all about sourdough. And so once you introduce a sourdough culture into your bread making, you're introducing this whole other variable and this whole other set of complications that, in my opinion, are worth it, because the quality in the bread can really go up. But it is a whole other thing to manage. And now it's not that complicated, but you got to spend a little bit of time, because what it is it's a kind of temperamental little pet, your sourdough culture, and you got to learn how to keep it happy.
Yeah, it's living. I mean, I've made yogurt and stuff too.
Yeah.
Now tell me this. The most popular thing now is like capturing wild yeast.
Yeah.
So
that's it.
But why is it, I keep reading all this stuff. I did this when I was doing fermentation with butter and stuff too. How do you keep the bad stuff out?
Ah, yeah, the bad stuff. That's where those razor blades come in. You got to stand guard 24 hours a day.
You see that bad yeast invading, you got to stop it. Huh? You got to slash its wrists.
Or maybe a sword. Maybe you need a sword or a bazooka. No, it's much more peaceful than that. Great question. And actually, this, I think, is the reason why most people are scared of sourdough, or if they've tried it, they've quote-unquote failed. And it's because the only way to let the bad guys win, to let the good guys die, is if you ignore it for too long. Okay? Because it's a sensitive little creature. It wants your love. You gotta love that sourdough starter.
Okay.
And what that means is every day or two, you actually throw out almost all of it, except just a little bit. You want a little bit of the seed culture left, so when you mix in more flour and water, there's some of those good guys left that are then gonna proliferate. And so, really, it's about feeding it, and by feeding it, I mean mixing in flour and water in a regular way. And so, once a day, once every 2 days, if you do that regularly, your sourdough starter is going to be healthy and happy and ready to make bread. And if that sounds like too much for you, you can actually stick it in your fridge and leave it there to a month or two.
So that's what you mean
that
by
slows it down.
That's the ultimate slowing it down.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you slow it to a crawl. And then when you want to make bread, you just take it out and you feed it daily for a few days, and then you're ready to rock.
Is it frustrating for you to have all these people who are gluten intolerant roaming around?
Oh, No, it's not frustrating. I mean, people are just trying to find out how to make themselves feel good. For whatever reason, right now, bread is the enemy in some people's eyes. But it's not. Over time, people will find out what actually is making them feel good or bad, and I'm not worried about it at all. We're making a gluten-free bread right now, and it's in the cookbook. It's called Adventure Bread, and it's a very dense, seedy loaf, and it's been really, really popular, even with who do eat bread made with wheat and gluten. And
you know, you talk about $4 toast. Have you checked out the cost of Thomas Keller's gluten-free flour?
Well, oh, I haven't. Is that pricey stuff?
I was about to say, if you go to Josie Baker's, the toast, the gluten-free toast is $5.
No, I mean, it's like $10 a pound or something.
Oh,
flour.
Dear.
Oh,
dear.
Oh,
wow.
It's ridiculous, but,
I don't know anything about that.
There's a recipe, actually, for gluten-free flour in Maximum Flavors. You know the Ideas in Food people? They have, their latest cookbook is called Maximum Flavors. It's quite good.
And, cool.
Yeah, I mean, they devote themselves, they're both chefs, they devote themselves to working out answers to,
difficult
to culinary questions. Culinary
dilemmas.
Yeah, but they have a recipe there, so you don't have to buy your gluten-free flour, you can make it yourself.
Yeah, you know, our gluten-free bread actually doesn't even have, it has, at the bakery we make it with a teeny bit of almond flour, but it's actually there's almost no flour in it at all. The binder is psyllium seed husk, and, in my experience, most things that are trying to replicate wheat flour and gluten, they fall terribly short. And so that's why with the Adventure Bread, we just took it in a totally different direction, which it's not like any bread you've ever had. But it's very delicious.
Well, we should add that you also cover interesting flavors in your breads. Also, you do pizza, which who doesn't want pizza? This one sounds good.
Who doesn't like pizza? That's what I'm talking about.
I don't like
gorgonzola and rosemary.
I don't like pizza even for $1.25 a slice.
Oh, come on, man.
You want to talk about communists, huh?
I'm a communist or a banker or something that rhymes with it.
A wanker.
you knew you were going to get that in there.
You set me up.
I was getting ready to say goodbye, but I knew that was part of what was required before you would leave us peacefully.
Josie Baker, your publicist was absolutely correct. You were a delight to talk to, and what fun we've had. So, and continued success.
Well, I appreciate that very much,
and
Sandy.
I promise you, next time we're in San Fran, I'm going to look you up and buy some toast.
Please do. Maybe I'll even give you a slice on the house with all the Marmite can find.
Josie Baker, it's been a pleasure, and we hope the rest of your day goes as well as it's gone so far.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, guys. Have a good one.
And we'll take a break now.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. If you say meatless, does that remind you of vegetarian?
Yeah, here's an interesting question, which I don't think we actually posed or answered in this next interview. Is bread vegetarian?
It depends on what kind of fat you use in it.
Is that what it is? Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So if you use tofu fat, that's all right. but if you use lard or if you use suet, it's certainly not.
No.
But it's a subject of great interest to more and more and more people.
Oh, people, especially this thing is everybody's doing Meatless Mondays, but Dina Cheney's book is called Meatless All Day. And,
okay, so
she says recipes for inspired vegetarian meals. And if you get a hold of this book, you'll find that you will have a different attitude about vegetarian. Meatless or vegetarian has become so much the norm that I'm amazed if I get a book that's not vegetarian. It's Dina Cheney. Your latest book is called Meatless All Day, Recipes for Inspired Vegetarian Meals. How does it feel to be absolutely in dead center mainstreamed with this vegetarian trend?
And I'm really excited to, you know, be kind of encouraging the trend. I eat about 40 to 50% of my meals are vegetarian. So this is a really fun project for me to work on.
Well, now, what inspired the book?
Well, basically, you know, what inspired the book is that so many vegetarian meals, and it's sort of the zeitgeist, and publisher wanted to do a vegetarian book, and something I was excited about. I'm a mom. I have two young sons. So I'm always just trying to get, you know, really delicious dinners on the table, meals on the table. And vegetarian, I often resort to cooking meatless, I mean, for a lot of reasons, but among them the fact that it's very convenient and easy and economical to cook meatless. So funny, when you write cookbooks like I do, you're kind of living that life for a year every time you take on a book project like this. And so I love the idea of spending a year just immersing myself in cooking vegetarian.
Right. Now, your idea, though, is anybody who wants to reduce meat intake or...
Right.
Now, you could pick up this book and find something if you want to be vegetarian, maybe one day a week or two days a week, right?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, there's a whole trend now, you know, the meatless Monday movement where you can eat, you know, meatless one day a week. But the exact sort of, the book is divided into breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So any meal you want to, you know, eat meatless, you can do that. And the idea was that every single meal would be satisfying to a carnivore, so that even someone who just is totally skeptical of meatless meals would find them satisfying. Yeah, if you want to eat meatless once a week or every single meal, do that and be satisfied. That was the idea.
Now, you mentioned Meatless Mondays.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that this originated with Herbert Hoover.
I know. Isn't that interesting? I know. I was surprised to find that out, too.
It was a wartime strategy.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's funny.
I know.
So you dug that a little bit, tidbit up.
Exactly.
Now, the other thing I found interesting was your tips for enhancing meatiness.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Okay, so basically, you know, what I wanted to try to do, like I mentioned before, is just to make every meal very satisfying. And there are many ways to do that. Load meals up with protein, make sure the portions are large enough, make sure there's plenty of contrast in terms of flavors, textures, and colors. But another way of doing that is to include a lot of ingredients that are rich in umami. Umami is the fifth taste, so the sweet, sour, you know, salty, and umami, and so it's a fifth taste. So if you think about Parmesan cheese, tomato paste, seaweed, mushrooms, sweet potatoes, they all share this umami quality, and it's hard to put into words, but it basically means, you know, savory or meaty. The term was, you know, coined into a Japanese word. So I use a lot of these umami-rich ingredients. Soy sauce is another one.
Right.
So you'll see throughout the recipes, you'll see a lot of tomato paste and soy sauce.
Right. Now, you also go for texture, too.
Exactly. Things like beets, things like breadcrumbs, you know, things like potatoes, beans. Yeah, things that have the mouthfeel, either the texture of meat, the flavor of meat, to really kind of, really to satisfy you. And exactly, you mentioned beets, and there's a recipe in the book for beet Wellington, and
yeah,
I love the classic meat dish, beef Wellington. So I thought, you know, I think a roasted beet steak, per se, would give you that kind of satisfying feeling, similar to a steak.
I remember several years ago we were at a conference and Sarah Moulton was one of the speakers.
Uh-huh.
And there were a lot of fine food lovers in the audience.
Yeah.
And she came right out and said the one thing she hated was beets.
Really? You know,
said they taste like dirt.
That's so funny. Some people really don't like beets. Do you guys like beets?
I would love them.
We love beets. We love the fact that they taste like dirt.
I love that too.
They're supposed to taste like that.
I mean, that's the other, from the earth, right? I mean, that's the idea, exactly.
Although, to add to the funny stories about beet that we've experienced, our cousin Jane, who grew up in England, spent several years in the United States as an au pair girl.
Uh-huh.
And she came to dinner with us once, and we love to cook beets. We love to cook them whole on the grill.
Yeah.
So beets were a vegetable that was included with meat, I might say, that was cooked on the grill.
Yeah.
And she said, "What's that?" And I said, "That's beets." She said, "Those aren't beets. Beets come in slices."
Oh, that's so funny.
Beets come in slices, and they're preserved with onions in vinegar. That's a beet. this is not a beet.
You know, I think what's key about beets is that, like, if you make sure that, you know, I think if you balance them out, I mean, they're so sweet and they're so rich, so it's good to balance them out with cheese or, you know, different ingredients, olives, something salty. I think that helps the people out there who don't like beets, try balancing out there with salty ingredients for contrast and try to, yeah, cook them, you know, make sure that you... There's nothing better than a roasted beet. I've never tried a beet on the grill. It sounds really good, though.
Oh, you can do the whole thing. Just the whole thing.
Yeah, you do it.
You don't peel it, I think.
I invented it, I think, because...
I've never heard... Do you just wrap the whole thing in aluminum foil and just throw it on the...
Here's how the recipe came about. My mother-in-law used to love beets.
Uh-huh.
And she used to boil them. And there was some particular reason, I think. I was cooking outside, and we had some beets. And I thought, you know what? All you're doing if you're boiling them is heating them, cooking them through.
Yeah.
Wouldn't they get a more interesting flavor?
Yes.
If you put them on the grill, so you take them the same way as if you boil them. You don't break don't break the skin, don't cut the taproot off.
Okay.
Cut the leaves off just like you would if you were going to boil them.
Okay.
And then you sprinkle them with salt and pepper, and coat them with olive oil. And then put them on the cold side of your grill.
Okay.
So if you're a grilling expert, you know about the cold side and the warm side. Well, you don't want them to burn because you know they're going to cook a long time.
Exactly.
So if you've got a beet the size of a softball, it's going to take you an hour to cook it.
Just like in the oven.
Takes exactly the same amount of time.
Okay.
So what you do is you keep it on the cool side of the grill and spray it regularly with a little more olive oil or some other vegetable oil.
Okay.
And you're away, and it comes out tasting a lot like meat.
And you said you did not wrap it in foil.
No, absolutely not. Because
you don't wrap it in foil.
You want the
crust.
Remember, you like to get crusts on things.
The crust, the exterior.
Like, does it get smoky?
Yeah, it does.
Mm.
It does. But the key thing is the crustiness.
Actually, that sounds amazing, and I've never heard that. That's a great idea.
Now, when we were talking before, I mentioned the fact that I don't know. I don't want to say it's cheating, but once you include eggs, you don't really have to worry about meat. I mean, you're already got. You don't have any meat in this book.
No meat in the book, or no fish either.
No fish sauce. No anchovies. None of that stuff. But you do have a lot of eggs.
I do,
and that makes everybody think they're eating meat anyhow.
I think the same thing. I mean, because eggs are so satisfying. I mean, what's more satisfying and pleasing than like a poached egg? I mean, right? It doesn't get better than that.
Right.
It's so wonderful.
Well, I
know. I really find that, I mean, there are some vegan recipes in the book, and I do cook vegan sometimes. So I can do it, but I feel like if I wrote a vegan cookbook, I would miss the ingredient I would miss the most would definitely be eggs.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that's the hardest part.
I think so, too.
Well, here's what I think you've done, and it's really not cheating at all. I mean, it's so sensible, you wonder why people haven't done it before.
Yeah.
It's to make vegetarian food taste just as good as the meat eater's food.
Yep.
Because of what you discovered. And
What I came up when I was conceptualizing recipe ideas, I basically thought to myself, okay, because I eat everything, I eat all vegetarian and I eat meat and fish, but let me come up with a list of my favorite meat and fish dishes and vegetarian dishes. And so for the vegetarian dishes, let me come up with, you know, really good takes on those. And then for the meat and fish dishes, let me come up with vegetarian versions that are just as good, if not better, than the meat and fish version. So that's why, that's why you have the beef Wellington, and you have, I love chicken Milanese, so I have a tofu Milanese, which I actually prefer to chicken Milanese. There's even a recipe that tastes like fish. It's like it's a seaweed-crusted tofu with the remoulade sauce. That tastes, I use Old Bay seasoning, so you really feel like you're at the shore. And then there's spaghetti with white bean meatballs. So they're vegetarian, but the white bean and the breadcrumbs and the herbs and the cheese give you the real feeling of traditional meatballs, and I actually like them better. So, yeah, that's what I was trying. I was trying to be really creative with this.
This is a book for those people who are tired of being noble.
Yes.
somehow being a vegetarian is a noble thing to be, and they put up with the fact that all this food is really boring.
Well, right. That's the thing, I know. Definitely not virtuous. I mean, there are some healthy recipes, but it's definitely not, you know, just overly virtuous food. It's satisfying. And there are dishes in here that are quite rich and decadent.
Now, you also organize it according to, it's organized according to mealtimes, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I think is very smart, because being vegetarian at breakfast time, it's probably much more difficult than being vegetarian at lunch or dinner time.
I think so, too. Actually, this is interesting. There's one of the surprises when I was brainstorming is there's a recipe in here where I mimic sausage. Breakfast sausage, I make, like, stuffed mushrooms, and I use fresh sage and maple syrup and breadcrumbs, and they taste like, you know, they taste like breakfast sausage. So that was that's kind of a surprising dish in here to kind of satisfy vegetarians, you know, satisfy meat eaters who always want to have a breakfast meat. Scrambled eggs with chives and maple mushroom bundles. That's the name of the recipe.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah. No, I mean, I like them. And I eat sausage, but I prefer these to sausage. And it's much healthier, too. No, you know, much lower in cholesterol.
Now, did you grow up, your background is Syrian. Did you grow up eating Syrian food?
Well, yeah, I did. So it's interesting. My dad is Syrian, and my mom is of Russian heritage. So, yeah, I ate a lot of Syrian dishes. There's a dish in here called pea jibin.
That's what I'm looking right at right now.
Well, yeah, so I had that probably once a week. It is the world's easiest recipe. It's so easy. You basically just whisk, you know, grated cheese and eggs and vegetables and some seasoning, and you throw it in the oven for, I think it's like 50 minutes, something like that. And it's basically like an egg and cheese casserole, similar to a quiche, but without the cream or the pastry crust. So it's super, it's much easier and much healthier and a lot easier. And you can use any vegetables you want, but here I use peas. But literally, like, my mom would make a pea jibin literally one night a week, because it's great for kids, too. So I ate that, and then they would make other dishes like kaskasun with chickpeas and a chini de pepe noodles.
Chickpeas are another lifesaver for vegans.
Yeah, right, and just lots of different. I do love the flavors of the Middle East, and I use a lot of those spices. And so you'll probably realize, like, if you look through the recipes, I'm sure it might be obvious, because I use a lot of cumin, I use a lot of coriander, and other, you know, ingredients from the Middle East, pomegranate, molasses, things like that.
Yeah, just saw in the store the other day, you could just buy the pomegranate seeds. What are they called?
Oh, the arils. I love doing that. You buy the arils. I have to admit, I often will buy them. It's so much easier than, you know, because it's hard to remove all the white membranes from the arils.
I think so, too, yeah.
Now, let me give you another great tip if you haven't found out already. Guess what? You can get frozen, fresh chickpeas off your Whole Foods market shelves. And made them a few times with fresh. She peeled them, I guess.
Oh, that's a nuisance. Fresh chickpeas in our farmer's market.
It's so much work.
Oh, it takes for hours.
That's a great tip.
But the frozen ones, the frozen ones are just as good.
Yeah, and they're not in brine like the canned.
No,
I've never seen that. So they come in a box?
No. They come in the frozen food section in a sachet like peas.
And here's my question. When you buy them frozen, are they, you know, when you buy canned beans, and I use them a ton in this book, I always use them, but you know how they're a little bit soft?
Yes.
When you buy them frozen, are they a little more fork tender? Are they a little less mushy?
No. I mean, they finish up like regular chickpeas that you just shelled.
No, but they're not mushy, Rabbit.
They're not mushy. That's great. Okay.
No, they don't go mushy at all.
Oh, that's fabulous. So it's just like you made, as if you made them from dried beans.
Except it happens much quicker.
That's phenomenal. I'm going to check that out.
Didn't we interview someone who wrote a Syrian cookbook? And she said standard growing up is people would just go out and pick a branch off of the chickpea tree and then stick it in the oven and roast it.
You're kidding. Oh, that sounds amazing.
I don't remember that, but that sounds almost as sensible as flash frozen chickpeas that you can buy from Whole Food Market.
So, but no, I mean, I think that what you've done here is you've left people with some treasures of cooking, such as butter. That's a big hurdle right there. If you can't use butter, and you know, milk and cream and all those things stay. So anybody who wants to cut back on meat consumption, and we all should do that, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
And here's a good way of doing it. Recipes from Dina Cheney's cookbook called Meatless All Day. Anyhow, I wish you lots of luck with your cookbook, Dina.
Thank you. It was a pleasure chatting with you both.
And you too. Bye.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Did you notice that Dana's voice is a lot lower than Keith's and Josie's? I don't know whether it's editor or whether, in fact, she does talk more softly, but she's certainly persuasive. And I'm sure you got her message now. Right after the break, we're just going to go straight arrow American, see if you can guess what's going to be on the menu in the final segment of the program.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Oh, okay, so you've had enough of all this artisan bread and all this vegetarian stuff. Let's do it for one of America's great favorite foods, which is at least partially vegetarian and partially bread, the good old hot dog. And the author of this particular book, Oat, H-A-U-T-E, dog, certainly knows a lot about dogs, and when you're done with it, you will too. Not only how to make them yourself, even how to make your own hot dog buns. So let's hear what's his name?
Russell Van Kranenburg.
Has to say.
Who'd have thunk that there could be an entire book on hot dogs? Thanks to Russell Van Kranenburg. Is that right, Russell?
Yes.
And the title is very clever. It's not called Hot Dogs. It's called Oat Dogs.
Or Oat Dogs, probably. With the
Oat, without the silent H.
Where the H is silent.
Recipes for delicious hot dogs, buns, and condiments. Whatever made you think of this?
Well, the hot dogs have always been a favorite snack of mine, even a favorite meal. And when I was approached by the publisher to do a book, we began throwing around ideas with my editor, and it kind of came to light that we both were hot dog fanatics. And it jokingly came up. It's like, well, why don't we just do a book about hot dogs? And it just rolled from there, because we started doing a little bit of research, and we realized that, well, it's actually, there's a lot of different hot dog varieties out there. It's a really interesting world.
Now, does every culture have a variety or a variation on the hot dog?
From what I could tell, pretty much. I mean, it really does look like the hot dog has spanned the globe by now.
But it's really a sausage. I mean, let's get back to how you defined a hot dog.
Yeah, so when we first started, my editor and I, we kind of set down a rule that we wanted to make sure the hot dog was something in a bun, but then also we didn't want to limit it to just frankfurters or like the traditional wiener you find in a grocery store. We kind of wanted to leave it open to maybe sausages and buns as well. So that really opened the door for a lot of European dogs. But then we kind of just blew right past that rule because we started introducing corn dogs and waffle dogs and other batter dogs, because we just found so many interesting ones all over the world.
Yeah, you really discovered that regionally across the United States and around the world, there's no such thing as a standard seasoning. The seasonings, I guess, are the things that really distinguish the dogs regionally.
Absolutely, and that's where you get these really quirky hot dogs. You start to see just toppings that maybe you'd never think to put on. At least, I mean, a lot of the dogs I came across, I would have never thought to put on some of these toppings. And that was a lot of the fun part, too, is finding out why certain cities prefer certain toppings over others.
Yeah, now, I remember the Rhode Island dog was one that was rather fascinating.
What's that one?
For a particular reason that's not intuitively obvious, or maybe you never find out. The sauce that goes with it happens to be very spicy. which is not really a Rhode Island thing, you wouldn't think.
No. And that one was really interesting because it was modeled after a dog that doesn't really even exist anymore. A lot of dogs in the Northeast and New England tended to be modeled after chili dogs or spicy dogs you'd find around the turn of the century in New York City. And so I guess as those lost popularity in the city itself, they kind of moved out to the suburbs and then eventually out to some of the other smaller states.
Now, the city with big shoulders, of course, Chicago, Illinois, they would claim that they are absolutely the ne plus ultra of hot dogs.
Yes.
Did you come across that? You must have.
I did. I mean, you see that a lot of places, too. People claiming that they invented it or claiming that theirs was the best. And it became contentious at times. People really take their hot dogs to heart.
Well, I'm looking at this picture that I can't even believe. Their Thai-styled fried dog. And they're works of art. They're sculptures on a stick.
Yeah, and you see a lot of these bad dogs are in the Thai-style fried dog, which is pretty much just a wiener on a stick that's deep-fried. I mean, you see a lot of these around Asia and the Pacific Islands. They're very popular as street cart food.
But it's cut in ways that is ornamental.
Yeah, that was what surprised me the most, and that's why I really wanted to make sure we got this dog in the book, because it's just the thing these vendors do. I mean, you just don't see that often. You don't see it here.
Now, did you taste all these? Did you travel around and taste them?
I did. I didn't get to go to every single location, but if I found a recipe and I found enough recipes that were similar from a location, I would make it at home and then give it a try.
But you were also, you started out buying dogs, right? So you were buying dogs from suppliers who specialized in dogs. And then just creating a sauce that went along with, a topping that went along with that.
Even a lot of times, though, a lot of these hot dog variations in different cities or countries, I mean, they're pretty specific with the type of wiener or sausage that they put in the bun. There are a lot of recipes in here that I just pretty much just copied and pasted. Or in a sense, I wanted to protect the recipe that's been in the city since its beginning.
Yeah, you wanted to maintain its integrity. I mean,
Golly,
an oat dog has to have integrity.
Yeah, absolutely.
It must be really important.
Well, I mean, this is so unusual, though. What did you find anything really surprised you besides the fact that they were proprietary about their product?
I think a lot of the Scandinavian dogs kind of threw me for a loop, just because a lot of them have mashed potatoes on them or just ingredients that I would have never thought to put on a hot dog, a shrimp salad. And a lot of their dogs, even they don't use the typical bun, they use potato bread or flat bread. And that's where, like I said earlier, we decided to bend the definition of a hot dog with it being in a bun, because the name for it really is hot dog in that country, and they really do consider it a hot dog. So it's very bizarre.
You have cute little boxed historical notes or other interesting notes. Like this one says, hot dogs in history, dogs as contraband mules. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, that was a big part of it. We came across so much random history that I just wanted to share some of these different stories we found. And what story did you just mention again?
Not everybody in the early 20th century liked dogs. They thought of them as the seedy underbelly of American corruption.
Oh, yeah. It was kind of interesting to track where the hot dog started from, because it really wasn't considered food that many people would want to even touch or get near. And
this one says, innocent-looking sandwich found to contain moonshine.
Yeah, and you would find all sorts of stories, and I mean, whether or not it was maybe competitors trying to discredit other vendors, or if it was somebody in high society just saying we don't want hot dogs in our city, but you would find these stories where people would try to claim that hot dogs were dangerous or that they contained cuts and meat from animals that, like your pets, or like they would make up these stories to I don't know if it was to try to run down their competitor or if it was just people who just really disliked hot dogs.
Well, it's probably true in the Philippines. Well,
hold on a
minute, dog.
But it is a hot dog after all, right?
Yeah, it's very interesting to see how did it get that name. I mean, you would hope it wasn't because they.
Now, people are used to laughing, they call them tube steaks.
Yeah.
Is that the right description, isn't it? I mean, that's the right nomenclature.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many different terms and nicknames, and that's another thing that kind of changes from one city to the next. In fact, Hot Dog, it wasn't the very first name that was used for them, but it was definitely coined, I want to say, in the very late 1800s, probably 1880s. So just a couple decades after the Hot Dog, as we call it today, came to be.
But you seem to trace the development of the American hot dog from the Frankfurter coming in from Germany.
Yeah, everywhere you can trace the hot dogs back, it tends to come from German settlers. Most all the stories do. And so it started to become very clear that it was probably inspired by the sausage-heavy culture over there, and they were bringing it with them. And over there, a lot of times, you see sausages served with rolls. So I don't know why it took immigration over here to America to have somebody put a slice in that bun, but it did, and the hot dog was born.
Yeah, you see, the equivalent in England would be what's called a sausage roll, but that's like a piece of sausage inside some pastry.
We have kolaches down here in Texas.
You do.
There you go. Yeah, so that's the same idea.
We actually have a kolache shop in Pittsburgh, believe it or not.
Oh, nice.
And then there's the legendary recipe for toad in the hole.
Yeah.
Which is like a batter, and then distributed through the batter are whole sausages.
Huh.
And that's.
So you do have a sequel. I thought you were joking about a sequel, but there's plenty. Russell, tell us, you are actually an award-winning blogger.
Yeah, that's kind of how I started with all this. I've been blogging for about 4 years now. My blog is Chasing Delicious, and originally we were doing really mostly desserts and baked goods. And from there we expanded a little bit. We started introducing savory items, meals, and then cocktails now. So really, I love all things food.
And do you do this full time?
Yes.
Now give us that blog name again.
It's Chasing Delicious.
ChasingDelicious.com?
Yes.
So what's next? What's the sequel?
Oh, well, who knows? It would be fun to do another one. I know there are so many more hot dogs out there, but...
Oh, I see. So you do Oat Dog Part 2.
Yeah.
Oat Dog Revisited.
We just may have to. Because I really did have to leave a lot of recipes out, which was a shame.
I thought you weren't going to succumb, but eventually you did succumb. So towards the end of the book, you actually have recipes so that people can actually make their own hot dogs.
Yes, and that was a little bit of a carryover from the blog, because on my blog, everything we do is from scratch. And I try to carry that philosophy with me through a lot of things. And so in the book, I wanted to...
Russell, who's we?
Oh, well, some of my other staff members and the people who help me out on the blog.
You have a whole staff?
Just a couple, yeah, just a few people that help out. But I really wanted to include all the from scratch recipes. I wanted to show people how to make their own homemade buns, their own sausages and frankfurters, and even their own condiments, because it's a lot of fun. I don't expect everybody to do it, because it can be time-consuming for some of it, but it definitely is a fun thing. I would suggest everybody should try it.
Right.
Well, we agree, and I don't know that we'll ever go back to the basic of making our own dogs, but the sourcing itself is very witty, I think.
Yeah. Well, good.
Anyhow, this is... A revelation. There are all these things that we didn't know about. We learned a lot from this book, and thank you very much for talking to us about it.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
And we hope you had fun here today with On the Menu's program for May 25th, and we'll hope to see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.